Welcome, this is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com and ClimateGate.tv, and today is the 24th of November 2011, and today I'm joined on the line all the way from Australia by Joanne Nova, who runs the very informative climate blog joannenova.com.au, and she is a science presenter, a writer, a speaker, and a former TV host. She has a Bachelor of Science degree with first-class honors from the University of Western Australia, where she majored in microbiology and molecular biology, and as I say, joannenova.com.au is an excellent source on the real history of the climate scandal that's been going on for many decades now. So, Joanne Nova, it's great to have you on the program. Thanks for joining
us
today.
Good to talk to you too.
Excellent. Well, I think obviously since this is your first time on the program, perhaps we should just go through an introduction of yourself and your site and the work that you do. And perhaps the best way to do that is to start with your new here, the 10-second guide to the world of skeptics, which is prominently linked from your front page, where you note that almost everything you thought you knew about man-made global warming might be a worthless half-truth, and you go through some of the main points there. So let's start with that and talk a little bit about the site and what got you interested in this topic in the first place.
Well, and that's a great question to start with, because it might shock people to know that although my full-time almost hobby occupation has become debunking the trying to find the correct answers on the science and how we can really help the environment instead of pursuing things which don't seem to produce anything useful, is that I used to be a member of the Australian Greens, and not just a member, but I was active. I was helping them raise funds and things for elections previously. I helped the Wilderness Society. I helped Greenpeace. I thought I was doing useful things for the planet. And about 4 years ago, my husband, who works for the Australian Greenhouse Office, well, he worked for them then, doing major carbon accounting modelling of the way carbon flows, not climate modelling, but carbon modelling, he came to me one day and he said, you know, there's no evidence at all that carbon is likely to cause a disaster. And I scoffed. I said, oh, you must be kidding. Of course there is. What about the ice cores? And he absolutely floored me then, because I had no idea, even though I read magazines like New Scientist every week and I followed things through Discover and through the popular science journals on the topic, I had no idea that there was an 800-year lag where temperatures rose first and CO2 rose 800 years after temperature. And yet here were we being sold Al Gore's graph, the only empirical evidence he used in his movie, that CO2 was causing the temperature rise and causing the falls, and yet it followed on the falls and it followed on the rises. And that really shocked me. It's not that that is definitive evidence all by itself, that carbon doesn't cause warming, but it tells you that the media is not giving us both sides of the story. And that flabbergasted me, so I had to start looking into it then. I thought it was the grandest failure of my profession, which is communicating science. And it's just taken off from there. I never expected to end up being, you know, a major blogger on the topic.
And yet you certainly are. You certainly become that. Absolutely. And on the back, yes. I think it's, as you point out, it's on the back of the extent of the not just the lies, but the omissions of the media that are supposed to keep us informed in these issues, and the absolute complete failure in that respect, that I think, like yourself, I had a very similar experience about 5 years ago when I started encountering this information that went completely in the face of everything I'd ever heard on the subject. And the more I looked into it, the more I found out it was actually true, which floored me even more. So I think that is an important way that a lot of people come into this this type of information.
It's true. And if the media hadn't kept one side of the debate so hidden from me, I probably wouldn't have been as shocked as I was at that stage. I mean, the papers from Ceylon, Italy in 2003, which definitively show that 800-year lag, was not mentioned by New Scientist, and I looked this up carefully, until 2007. So it took them 4 years to even mention it, and when they did mention it, it was in one of their myth-busting pieces of, here's why this paper that we never mentioned and we didn't tell you doesn't show anything important.
Exactly. And, right. Methinks they doth protest too much.
Yes. So it is, and I wrote to them about that too. And I think the saddest thing in this is that a lot of journalists have lost their professional ethics, and they're putting their own personal political opinions and ideals ahead of the search for the truth and to find the answers. And you know what? I'm disappointed in myself years ago for not noticing that when people were called deniers, that should have been a red flag to me, because no topic in science should be reduced to a name-calling debate. It is not, it's not a point of science to start calling names to your opponents. And so I should have noticed back then, once they started using the term deniers, that something was up.
Indeed. Well, obviously, this is just such a politicized issue that that the science is, it really does seem secondary to all of the politics that go on around it. But I think one thing that woke a lot of people up to what was going on, a lot of people who hadn't been looking into this for themselves yet, was the, of course, the 2009 leak of emails from inside the hallowed halls of academia and many of the institutions, including the University of East Anglia, that are working on this climate problem, as they deem it, at any rate. And that ClimateGate leak of emails, of course, becoming quite a huge issue only after having been relentlessly pounded on by the bloggers and the people in the alternative media for many weeks. Finally, the Guardian and other mainstream publications started to really pick up the story, and then we saw all the whitewashes that came out of that. But for people who are really just approaching this or want to get an overview of it, I could not stress more strongly that they should go to Joanne Nova's website and get ClimateGate 30 Years in the Making, an absolutely incredible timeline of ClimateGate and all of the things surrounding that. So perhaps we can start talking about the history of ClimateGate with this document in mind, because it's just an incredible overview. So I'd like to know how this came together.
It's interesting, isn't it? A volunteer approached me, and this is how almost everything is done that's associated with my site and with a lot of the skeptics. There are a few skeptics who have real jobs at universities, like Richard Lindzen and Roy Spencer, but many of the skeptics, the vast majority of them, are just people like myself who are doing this out of sheer outrage that the people are being ripped off, that my profession is being turned into a joke, it's being exploited by the politicians as an excuse for eking money out of people. And I should add, and the giant financial houses of the world are also benefiting from this, and they are one of the major players in this. And I used to, at one stage, be a gold trader. And so, as in Forex trading, or not Forex, Comex trading, and the Comex exchange on gold futures. So it wasn't long after I got involved with this that I started to think, well, hang on, follow the money. Where is the money moving in this? How big is carbon trading? And I looked it up and was shocked to find that each year of carbon trading, we're turning over around about $140 billion a year. So this is a major turnover. It was projected at one stage by the Commissioner of the Futures and Commodities Exchange in the US, Bart Chilton said it will become a $2 to $3 trillion market if it goes global. So you can see the dollar signs running on this. It would have been the largest commodity market in the world, bigger than oil, bigger than coal. It's mind-boggling. And these financial institutions, they make money no matter who buys, no matter who sells, doesn't matter what the price is. They're the brokers of every deal. And so all of the big banks, the HSBCs, the Barclays banks, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan's, they're all keen for this to go through. And why wouldn't they be? They'd have to be crazy not to, because it means money in the bank for them, and an entire fiat currency virtually invented out of nothing to draw money from the people and put it through financial houses.
Absolutely right. Just an incredibly important part of all of this that most people don't think to even look at, because obviously this is just a scientific debate. How could it have anything to do with this vast market that's being created? And yet when you do look into it and see all of the money that's trading based on this scientific fraud, I mean, it becomes apparent that there is a lot more to this than just the science. But from the scientific perspective, this document, this 30 years in the making, just an incredible overview.
Yes, I know, and I'm sorry, I've tripped us off the topic there, but I think to me that the money explains a lot of why this has survived the way it is. Yes, the science of this is just extraordinary. What's going on behind the scenes is thousands of whistleblowers who are mostly volunteers, as I said. They are downloading data from NOAA and NASA. A lot of them are retired engineers and geologists, people with math backgrounds and IT backgrounds, and they're downloading the data. I mean, if you're retired, this is much more intellectually stimulating than bowls and bingo. You can pull down the data, you can find holes in it, you can correct supposedly hallowed leading authors of the IPCC, and some people have done that, like Stephen McIntyre, and published papers based on it. So there's this extraordinary game going on behind the scenes, and it's fascinating to watch that and to see just how big that whistleblowing revolution is. I've never seen anything like it in science. But what came out in ClimateGate 1, it didn't shock us, those of us who'd been watching the debate, because we knew that the behaviour of the leading authors was very poor, very unscientific. We'd seen that already in the email responses they had given, in the way they hid their data. But what it did was confirm that. and confirm all of those things we knew, and suddenly it brought in a whole lot of other people. And to hear people writing about how they were using tricks to hide declines, you know, put that in perspective, you can't excuse that as something to say, you know, this is a trick to get the photocopier working. This is a trick to hide a decline in a graph, which is billions of dollars depends on this graph and amongst others like it. So, you know, we were talking about fraud and collusion and virtually almost criminal activity. And I've seen some people suggesting it breaking, especially FOI, the Freedom of Information Act in the UK, where you're not allowed to delete emails that are under FOIA. And effectively, Phil Jones has admitted that he was doing just that in these emails. So it was a blockbuster, and in the next few weeks leading up to Copenhagen in 2009, after this broke, I was getting emails from people around the world, nuclear scientists in California, surgeons in Sydney, legal experts in London, professors of physics in Norway. You know, it was fascinating, because what ClimateGate One did was brought in a lot of people who'd noticed this and thought it was a bit scammy, but once they saw the fraud that was going on, they were suddenly just, you know, it was like a rocket was put underneath them. Everyone suddenly now wanted to bust the cheats. And so it brought lots of new people into this debate, and the traffic on websites, on skeptics' websites, jumped kind of fivefold or tenfold literally overnight when it broke. So I can't underestimate the importance of the ClimateGate One emails that came out.
Well, exactly as you say, it did confirm what a lot of us who had been following the debate for a while already knew. And in fact, I had already had an interview with Tim Ball earlier that year, where he was talking about some of the very things that came out in the ClimateGate emails later that year, talking about those freedom of information requests and the shenanigans that were going on around it. And just to back up what you're saying about the breaking of the law in that regard, it's a little a fact that isn't really touted very much. But at the end of January, it was quietly admitted that the UK Information Commissioner had in fact found that that Phil Jones had broken the freedom of information laws by conspiring to ignore the requests for information and conspiring to delete the emails. They actually ruled that it was in breach of the laws, but unfortunately it was a statute of limitations type of thing where they didn't have the authority to go after him for that violation of law. So in fact he was found actually criminally guilty of that. So that's an important thing to keep in mind.
And released on a legal technicality. And that's interesting, because really I should know that, and that sort of information ought to be amongst, but all of it gets lost in the details, doesn't it? It's just so much easier to say, well, they were vindicated by three or four committees.
Exactly. So let's talk a little bit about that, because unfortunately that's exactly what we saw come out of all of this incredible ClimateGate scandal, was these whitewash commissions, one after another, that claimed to have vindicated the scientists.
Well, yes. And, you know, some of these commissions, which lasted for a mere 24 hours or something, interviewing these scientists, supposedly, were checking upon 2 decades of information coming out of the IPCC and confirming it all in a day, except that they really admitted they weren't checking the science anyway. Whether that started off as one of the aims in some of these committees, it was virtually dropped through all of them. So most of the time they were really looking at legal technicalities or other things, and not about whether the science made sense, not about whether the information affected our decisions on anything to do with this. And they didn't even try with some of those commissions. One of them was led by Lord Oxford, who at the same time was chairing a wind farm. So, I mean, there's a conflict of interest for you. They didn't even try and hide. They didn't even try and pick a chairman who wasn't chairing a wind farm. It shows you how weak the efforts were and how easily they think they get away with this. This is what's quite scary, because in a normal media where we had true investigation from unbiased journalists, or journalists who were able to put their own personal biases behind them, surely no commission which was chaired by someone with such an obvious conflict of interest would be taken seriously. And yet they got away with it, largely, because the media does not enforce that kind of thing, did not point out those glaring flaws. And yeah, so exactly. This is where I come back to it. I think the problem is the media. We wouldn't have such poor politicians, such weak scientists, such minimal public debate if the media truly investigated both sides of the story and put it forward.
Absolutely agreed. And yet the remarkable thing from my perspective is that often when I broach this subject with people who are still true believers in the global warming phenomenon, they will always come back to me to say, well, obviously the media is controlled and they're on the side of the skeptics. And I just find that bizarre that people even posit that. But I see from their perspective, I suppose, why they say that.
But. No, but the way to rebut that is to point out things like, you know, surveys on the public of how much they understand about climate change and global warming. And, I mean, you look at the things. One of the men on my site did a great survey of 100 people where he asked them questions about carbon. Now, here in Australia, we have been indoctrinated with a carbon is pollution meme through the advertising from the government. And what's quite scary is that everything anybody learned at high school has been just dumped and forgotten in the last 10 years as we've been under siege by this carbon is pollution meme. And so he could ask them questions like, would you feel better if we remove the carbon from your food? And yes, quite a lot of people would. They'd prefer to eat food without carbon in it. I mean, a third of the population said something like that, would prefer to eat food without carbon.
Perhaps they'd like to get rid of dihydrogen monoxide as well.
Well, yes, I'm sure that would go down well as well. I mean, people we said, would they feel uncomfortable if they knew there was CO2 in their bodies? Well, yes, actually, they would like to get the CO2 out of their bodies as well. And you think, it's just become inane. The government propaganda in this has been so strong. It's undone basic science instruction about, you know, we are carbon life forms, and taken it over as pollution. And to me, that tells you that the media is very much on the other side. Because the media would laugh at any government campaign trying to pretend that carbon is pollution if it was even moderately close to the centre.
Well, indeed. In fact, that even gets into the semantic issues involved, because, of course, carbon dioxide is one thing, but it's often elided as carbon. And of course, I mean, that in itself is just an immense oversimplification of what's going on. So it does really point to the utter scientific ignorance of the vast majority of the public. And really, I think, as you point out, that's maintained by a media that unfortunately caters to the lowest common denominator.
I think it's worse than catering to the lowest common denominator. I think the media is catering to its own personal biases. We know that a lot of people in the media vote left. It's well known from studies that most journalists prefer to vote left. And I think, unfortunately, it's just a sordid case of them putting their own personal preferences, which is for big government solutions to things, into their research. And they simply don't look. It's not so much necessarily overt dishonesty. It's merely that they just don't look for anything that conflicts with their own personal biases of what they believe to be true.
Well, and that's not even something we have to speculate about. Of course, we've had the original ClimateGate was apparently originally leaked a few weeks beforehand to a BBC journalist who decided to shut up about it.
I know. That it's kind of dumbfounding, isn't it, that he could have had all that a whole month before. You know, people say the media is only catering to the big scoops and that the media is only looking for the disaster headline, but I actually think that misses the point. The media is really looking, like a lot of people, for things that reinforce their own personal prejudices and views, and that's where this comes to, because there's a BBC reporter missing a giant scoop and a major headline because he really didn't want to look.
Exactly. Well, the scientific scandal of the century so far, at any rate. So, so certainly that it is almost mind-boggling. But let's transition now into this week's newest ClimateGate 2.0. And this is a story. It's so brand new. I'm not even sure all of my listeners are aware of it. So perhaps you can tell us what you know about this story and how it came to develop.
Oh, well, it's one of those exciting things that comes in on a Wednesday night. I'm sitting down at my computer and I notice I've got an odd comment in from someone called FOIA. Now, FOIA was the one who broke out the information about the ClimateGate 1. And I didn't twig immediately, and because it was a Russian site that it linked to, I'm always very dubious because you never know. But the emails were starting to flood in from people saying ClimateGate 2 is broken. And that was, my site was one of five or six that he had left the link on. And so I quickly searched, and sure enough, people had checked, and we were still waiting to confirm that the emails were legitimate. But within hours, the people who were accused of things in the emails or who wrote the emails were confirming that it was true and saying, oh, yes, we've seen them, but they don't mean anything. Don't look here, ladies and gentlemen. There's nothing to see. And which was great because it tells us that they were authentic and they were real. But some of the messages coming out there, the main theme is that these scientists will say something. They admit discussions about uncertainty amongst themselves, which they don't tell the public. Remember, we're beaten down with the message, the science is settled, the evidence is overwhelming, and the models are right, and there will be a disaster. And yet behind the scenes, they're saying things like the basic problem is that all the models are wrong, not got enough middle and low-level clouds. And that comes from Phil Jones. one of the four major centres researching. So it's just, to me, there's message after message like that. Observations, there's Thorne. Observations do not show rising temperatures throughout the tropical troposphere unless you accept one single study and approach and discount a wealth of others. This is just downright dangerous. Or how about from Wills? Will's comments, what if climate change appears to be just mainly a multi-decadal natural fluctuation? They'll kill us, probably. I mean, how bad is that? These people know that their models are not giving them the right results, and they won't admit it publicly, but they're sending emails back and forwards to each other saying they don't like it. And Michael Manns, who did the hockey stick, which was a study showing that temperatures are unprecedented in the last 1,000 years, but it was in conflict with literally hundreds of previous studies showing that there was a warm period 1,000 years ago called the medieval warm period. Michael Mann, that data, that graph was so bad you could have generated it with random numbers. They didn't need the tree ring proxy data that he put in to pretend to analyse temperatures for the last 1,000 years. His mathematical algorithm was so bad you could throw in a bus timetable and you would still get a hockey stick.
That's right. And so, in fact, if I'm reading it correctly, one of the emails that's been highlighted here actually confirms that very fact from one of the hockey team themselves who tried it out and said, oh, actually, it seems McIntyre's right. You can't feed in any numbers into
this.
Yes,
yes, that's right. They're confirming they did try some of the things that they baked the critics for and yet found the critics were right. And, you know, Bradley here is one of the authors on that famous 1998 paper. He says, I'm sure you'll agree, the Mann-Jones GRL paper, and he's talking about a 2008 paper, I think, was truly pathetic and should never have been published. I don't want to be associated with that 2,000-year reconstruction. So there's very strong language here going on behind the scenes with these scientists, and yet the main frame, the main image that we're painted in the public is that, that this is supposedly just healthy scientific debate is how they whitewash it, which would be fine, it'd be true, if they let the public know that they really weren't sure what their models were projecting, that their models aren't good at projecting the temperatures above the tropics, which is critical, and all of this goes on behind the scenes, and yet it's kept from us.
Exactly right. Unfortunately, exactly right. And for people who haven't actually taken a look at these emails yet, you have got the link up on your website. Of course, it keeps changing and dropping because it's on a number of different hosting websites.
It keeps being swamped. But there are a lot of sites analyzing these emails, and hopefully soon we will have boiled down the ones which are the most important. But to be honest, we've already got enough. I mean, there's another one here from Pollack, and remember the medieval warm period I'm talking about. He's quoted and said, but it will be very difficult to make the MWP go away in Greenland. Now, this is not a scientist speaking where you try and make a warm period disappear from your graphs. You know, the true scientist wants to know whether it was really there or whether it wasn't. And yet in this case, they're trying to create graphs to fit in with political memes. And, you know, these are scientists being human, but we expect better from people who we're entrusting decisions that billions of dollars are resting on.
Well, trillions of dollars, ultimately. And in fact, that's something that was pointed out in the readme.txt file that was included with this batch of emails that reads, over 2.5 billion people live on less than $2 a day. Every day, nearly 16,000 children die from hunger and related causes. $1 can save a life. The opposite must also be true. Poverty is a death sentence. Nations must invest $37 trillion in energy technologies by 2030 to stabilize greenhouse gas emissions at sustainable levels. And it goes on to say, today's decision should be based on all the information we can get, not on hiding the decline. This archive contains some 5,000 emails picked from keyword searches. A few remarks and redactions are marked with triple brackets. The rest, some 220,000, are encrypted for various reasons. We are not planning to publicly release the passphrase. So a very cryptic message from whoever is leaking these emails out, but a very interesting manifesto there.
It is, and the encryption on those 220,000 emails, I believe, is some 4,000 to 8,000 digits long. So it's a very difficult encryption to break. So, yes, and we can all speculate on why he may have done it that way or she may have done it that way. I think possibly they're saving it up as a warning to the scientists to say, you know, you need to be honest, you need to do the right thing, you need to give out your data and your methods. And without FOIs, this is the thing most people don't realise, is that it was one of the understood things about science. When you've published a paper, if any scientist anywhere in the world asks you for the data and wants to check it, then you should give them not just the data, but the methods so that they can replicate what you did. And, yeah, this is how science works. So we can check to make sure they didn't make adjustments which don't make sense, or that it doesn't depend on some particular one point that they haven't got right. And that's how science works. You shouldn't have to put in an FOI to get that kind of stuff. And yet here we've found when we do put in an FOI, Phil Jones is just deleting the emails, is deliberately giving skeptics data which he knows will be difficult for them to work with, or that's missing some crucial elements, or that's confusing, or, you know, all sorts of ways. So just try and foil people from analysing their own work and checking it.
Exactly right. Well, let's approach this from the other way around, because obviously with your background in science communication and obviously being involved in the media and trying to communicate science, you know how the people who are involved in communicating this type of thing to the public think. So if you were in the position of someone at The Guardian or one of these papers that are obviously going to try to cover up this incredible story, what do you think they're going to be doing in the next few days and weeks to try to smooth this out and try to make people go back to sleep?
Well, we've already seen the handy guide to, I'm writing it at the moment, the handy guide to spot whitewashed journalism. We've already seen the way The Guardian and others will deal with it. And that they were quicker this time. They were absolutely stumped when ClimateGate 1 came out. There was this vacuum in the media for the next 4 or 5 days, which was really extraordinary. And where even sites like Real Climate, which is one of the main sites for the alarmists, just said nothing because they didn't know what to say. They were flabbergasted. This time around, within hours, the BBC and The Guardian were both putting out what I call whitewash journalism, where they don't quote any of the emails found. They merely quote the excuses given by the people who were caught by these emails, who are just saying, well, they're old, you know, they're pretty much, this is old news, we've seen it all before, we've been investigated, all the investigations said we're okay, and they were hacked, these people are nasty, and this is what it comes back to, so the standard excuses for all these things. But you can always spot a real journalist because the real journalist will quote what the emails were, and also quote what Michael Mann's excuse and Phil Jones's excuses are, which is quite fair to ask them their opinion and get them to quote on it. But if they don't quote the actual emails that were busted out, then they're hiding things.
Precisely right. And that's such an important point, because something that I noticed about when they finally did start covering ClimateGate the first time around was that it all seemed to hinge on the hide the decline quote. And there was a lot of talk about that and a lot of going and hemming and hawing about what that meant. And, oh, it's the trick doesn't mean anything important and all of that discussion. But that was really the only email that was examined in any sort of depth at all. And there was literally thousands and thousands and thousands of others. And a lot of people in the alternative media were pointing out all of the other things that were going on there. But of course, the media tried to make it about that one quotation. And unfortunately, I think to a certain extent, it probably worked with at least their diehard readership. So again, I assume that's probably exactly what's going to happen this time around. They're going to try to avoid any discussion of what the emails actually say and just try to put it off on these councils and whitewash commissions that have decided that these people did nothing wrong.
Yeah, and just make sure that everybody knows the skeptics are cherry-picking, even though they won't really produce any examples of where the skeptics are cherry-picking. But it's funny, you know, I just tripped across an email this morning showing that Phil Jones was saying that he doesn't consider himself a public servant. This is a man who works for the University of East Anglia and who gets a lot of grants from both the UK government and the US government. And yet here he is. It's part of the way he justifies the fact that he's not giving out this data. He calls it, you know, it's his intellectual property, and actually says he does not consider himself a public servant.
Quite remarkable, and especially if people do take the time to look into his grant funding, and some of that did come out in the original ClimateGate emails, and people were adding up the sums of the grants that he received and coming to quite exorbitant figures. I won't quote them because I don't know them off the top of my head, but that's contained at ClimateGate.tv and other places. So I hope people do check into that, because they have to understand there is vast amounts of money to be made, even personally, by some of the key figures in this climate world.
There are. Although, as I said, I think a lot of this is really about people's, you know, the human flaws and the human folly of thinking that they know what's best. And I can see in the emails, they're really just struggling to explain why it's unfortunately a religious belief, just doesn't add up. And they're convinced that 28 million radio sons must be wrong because it doesn't match their models and their conviction that the world must be warming catastrophically due to CO2. Whereas, you know, I'm, I guess, one of those lukewarmer skeptics. I don't know. Are you familiar with that term?
Yes, yes. But let's flesh it out for the listeners.
A lukewarm skeptic means someone who admits that CO2 is a greenhouse gas. I mean, I'm not denying any physics at all. CO2 is a greenhouse gas. Humans are producing it. Yes, it is warming the planet. But we argue that the feedbacks are negative, and that means clouds and humidity are changing in ways that reduce the effects of CO2's additional warmth, and that we're likely to get more like half a degree of warming, not 3.5 degrees, which is what the IPCC says, or if you're Ross Garnaut in Australia, you get 5.7 degrees. Some of the models turn out 11 degrees. And all of those estimates above 1 degree are all based on positive feedback. They're all saying CO2 warms the planet by 1 degree. The generally accepted figure quoted from Hansen 1984 is 1.2 degrees due to CO2 directly if it doubles. But all the warming above that is only found in models and only found when they assume that feedbacks are positive. So that's what this debate is really about, whether they've got the feedbacks right, whether they've made an error cascade, an assumption that humidity would increase in a warmer world up high in the atmosphere, whereas we're saying, well, actually it looks like humidity increases low in the atmosphere, we get more clouds, and more clouds send more of that radiation off the planet and the world cools slightly. So CO2 is increasing temperatures, but we're saying not by much, not by anything that matters, and we really ought to be paying more attention to those poor starving kids.
Exactly right, and that brings up the point that that a lot of the terminology surrounding this, the whatever it is that we are doing collectively on sites like joannenova.com.au and climategate.tv, there's a lot of labels that are applied to that, like climate skeptic, which just makes it sound ridiculous in and of itself, because of course no one is skeptical that there is a climate or that the climate is changing. I think it's ultimately what the root cause and what the ultimate effects are the contentious issues.
You are so right on that, James. Yes, it's Orwellian, isn't it? And they say we're a climate denier, as if I deny there's a climate. I'm a climate change denier, as if I'm denying that the climate ever changes. Yes, it is preposterous. And the Orwellian tricks work against us all the time. Confusion works for them, and straight information works for us. But unfortunately, they have the megaphone through the media. So, but we've got the internet, and boy, do skeptics dominate the internet. You can see on all the polls that happen on most of the websites on this that skeptics quickly come in and swamp the polls that are taken. And I think that's just the way it is. If you're online, you probably have read a lot of the skeptical positions and are more likely to be a skeptic, whereas unfortunately if you're only reading the mainstream media newspapers, it's very hard to find out what's going on.
And there again, that's a point that I've reflected on quite a lot since ClimateGate originally broke in 2009, is that the ClimateGate itself would have been completely impossible without the internet, as was proven by the fact that it was given on a silver platter to the BBC, who declined to even mention it until it was broken by the alternative bloggers. So the internet is truly a key part of this whole puzzle.
It is, and we're calling it the new media, and the old media, of course, is it's very well set up to help big government and large financial houses. Not that I'm suggesting that there's necessarily a big conspiracy going on there, just that it's a systematic flaw and it's evolved that way. So we have a systematic point where the media caters to a certain point of view and a certain audience and attracts journalists that fit that in. If you don't fit in with that, then you are kind of excommunicated. And speaking as someone who used to speak on our ABC in Australia, which is our public broadcaster, yes, you wouldn't be able to admit that you were a skeptic, for they would be calling you names. They do call people names on our ABC, and to me that's just shameful that our Prime Minister's reduced to calling people names to say people are deniers. And I'm very sad to see the lack of manners and the lack of intellectual debate that this has been reduced to. So, again, yes, funny, I sound like my grandma. I'm going to be coming to campaigning for good manners. I think if we had good manners, we would have seen a lot more of this information come out much sooner.
Mm. Well, it's absolutely true. I completely agree with that. I think there is hope in all of this, I suppose, insofar as this is coming out, and sites like yours are doing so much to bring this to the awareness of people who otherwise truly would have no link to it. So we have to really give you our thanks for all of the work that you've been doing on this and all of the climate-related issues over the years. Once again, throw out the website address once again and tell people how they can find your work.
It's joannenova.com.au. And the Skeptics Handbook was a production that I put out. That was me coming onto the scene, because having been to Bali, I went to the UNFCCC. My husband was invited to go. And I said, oh, I'm not going to miss that. So I came along as this kind of new skeptic, and there were 12 of us skeptics amongst the 12,000 attendees of the UNFCCC conference in Bali 2007. And yeah, it was so much fun. But the astonishing thing is, you know, we talk about junkets. This is part of the amount of money involved in this. How big is a big conference? You know, you'd think 1,000 people for 3 days is a big conference, but this had 12,000 people and it lasted for 2 weeks. Can you imagine the amount of money and the amount of carbon dioxide produced in the quest there? And yet there were us 12 skeptics, which also included Christopher Monckton. It was an absolute blast to meet him, and Mark Morano, who runs Climate Depot, and others. So it was just brilliant. And we had a field day, but I came away from that thinking even my skeptics weren't necessarily well-informed and well-versed on the simplest arguments to take to argue this case, which I had done through the media tent for the 10 days I was there. And that's why I produced the Skeptic's Handbook, which is just 16 pages. It's a great way to start if you're looking for a beginning in this. It's got lots of graphs, only 200 words a page. It's very short and quick, and gets to the real nub of what science is supposed to be, about the search for the truth and why we can't rely on authority or opinion. And it's the evidence that matters, and we need to get back to that, the observational evidence, not the models.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and that's the point that unfortunately isn't stressed enough, so I'm glad that that resource is there, and of course it's linked prominently from the front page of joannenova.com.au, so people can find it quite easily. And finally, you said you're working on a report on whitewash journalism?
Oh, I'm just going to put up a blog post soon, which is just pointing out how to spot the difference between a real investigative journalist and a PR journalist. And the difference being mostly, you know, the investigative journalists would quote both sides of the story. They would pick out the most damning emails that were found in the Climategate debate and put them up. And they would ask the people who made those emails for why they said it, what's the excuse, how else do we view this, what other context is there. Yeah, this is the way good journalism works. We should get both sides of the story in the story, and then you know the person has really tried to find the answer. Instead, almost all of the reports I'm seeing, Associated Press, through The Guardian, through the BBC, are people who are doing what I call PR journalism. They're literally just parroting the agencies and the government bodies, and they're helping to defend the people who were hiding, who were hiding data, hiding and using tricks to hide declines, and using tricks to hide from FOIAs. You know, these journalists are being apologists for scientists who are perverting the truth.
Indeed. Well, I think we'll wrap up the conversation there. Just so many points and so many things to go over. But again, people can look into joannenova.com.au for more on that. And I'm sure we'll see a lot more coming out of Climategate 2 in the coming days, whether that be more whitewash or more revelations. But either way, I hope people are staying tuned to this very important issue. So thank you so much for your time today, Joanne. It's been a pleasure
talking
to you.
Thank you.